Today we're going to begin looking at effector mechanisms in neurons. We've looked at how things can get into systems. We've looked at different types of curves. We've looked at different presynaptic mechanisms. And we've looked at receptor binding. So when we talk about effectors, it has multiple different meanings. And most cells, including neurons, there are multiple effector mechanisms. Very often we'll use the terminology multiple messenger systems, multiple ways to convey information. From cell to cell, obviously by neurotransmitters, across the cell membrane, and then within the cell, other messenger mechanisms. And we're very used as neuroscientists to thinking about transmembrane messengers, particularly ions flowing through ion channels. As we'll see, that's just one small portion of the constellation of different types of messengers that can be used for cellular communication. There can be small lipid-soluble molecules that can cross the membrane, that can be transmembrane messengers. They have to be lipid soluble to get to that through that lipid bilayer, unless they're actively transported. And we'll talk about transport mechanisms later on in the semester. We have various things that are membrane-bound messengers. Membrane-bound. So where would you think they would be located within the cell? Not necessarily axon terminals, attached to the cell membrane. Could be distributed anywhere across the cell surface. Is that the only place you find membranes in neurons? No, there's lots of intracellular structures that are membrane-bound as well. Vesicles were obviously a special case, and we don't usually look at receptors on vesicles themselves, but the endoplasmic reticulum, as we'll see extensively on Thursday, is another site where we find membrane-bound receptors. Those are then intracellular receptors, not cell surface receptors. Then we have diffusible messengers, intracellular messenger molecules, things that can move freely within the cytoplasm of the cell. And then obviously we have contained within another set of membranes, within the nuclear membrane, various genomic messengers, things that interact with the DNA in cells, or proteomic messengers, those involved either with the production of proteins, with ribosomes, or with some modification of proteins once they're synthesized. So we talk about transcriptional messengers, those within the nucleus, translational messengers, those that affect protein synthesis, and then post-translational messenger systems, things that modify proteins in some particular way. These are not exclusive categories. We'll see that many types of ions can act as diffusible messengers once they get into cells. We'll look at particularly at the role of calcium ions for that purpose. We'll see that various diffusible messenger systems may have post-translational effects on proteins. They'll do things like phosphorylate proteins or dephosphorylate them or chop them up in various ways or add different components to them. So those are not exclusively different categories there. Okay. And we'll be looking at much more complex diagrams than this over the next few days' time. Okay. And that's straight out of your textbook. Very often we use the term receptor-effector coupling and look at the various mechanisms to couple those membrane receptors, which can receive the message from another cell, particularly from another neuron, to things that can then change the activity of a cell. The effectors. We basically divide those into two major categories, those that are membrane-associated, membrane receptors, and then this different category, intracellular receptors, those are, that are not associated with the membrane. They're freely moving around in the cytoplasm themselves. So first at the membrane receptors, we have three basic categories, and we'll spend most of our time on these first two. One, again, as neuroscientists, you're probably very familiar with, inotropic receptors. They contain as part of their structure an ion channel. And that ion channel is activated by binding of a neurotransmitter. Anybody think of an example of that? Name one. Nicotinic receptor. Right. There are some glutamate receptors, but just saying glutamate receptor alone is not good enough. Okay. There are some muscarinics not. Doesn't activate an ion channel. How about serotonin? There is actually one serotonin receptor that's inotropic. How about norepinephrine or dopamine? Any of those inotropic? Anybody know? Nope. Either one. Okay. What other neurotransmitters do you know? Acetylcholine. Well, that was muscarinic and nicotinic. So, caffeine. Okay, that's not a neurotransmitter, although you might think it is by now. Caffeine interacts with adenosine receptors, which are not inotropic, but it also interacts with a membrane-associated receptor in the endoplasmic reticulum, and we'll be looking at that on Thursday. Not a neurotransmitter, though. Okay.
How do you define neurotransmitter?
Something that's released by a neuron, it's been packaged up in a vesicle first, and released in a calcium-dependent fashion. One other. Caffeine isn't released by neurons.
Well,
something you have to drink.
Right.
Or inject or something.
What could you call it? Is there a name for it?
It's a ligand. It's a drug. Okay. Even though if you go to the 7-Eleven and go, I want some drugs today, they probably won't automatically think of caffeine. But it is a drug. Okay. So inotropic has to do with opening ion channels so that some of those transmembrane messengers can get in or perhaps get out of the cell. Then we have what are called metabotropic receptors. Metabotropic. They modulate the metabolism of the cell. They change the metabolism. Most frequently by changing the activity of enzyme systems in the cell. And we'll talk about some of those enzyme systems just a little bit today and in great detail on Thursday. Okay. And then finally, just for completeness, we'll throw in the other one, tyrosine kinase coupled receptors. Obviously, a kinase is an enzyme. It's a special category of them where the receptor itself actually has that enzyme activity. So when the receptor binds the transmitter, it then can phosphorylate other proteins. And in neurons, that's most typically associated with growth factors. Anyone ever heard of NGF, neuronal growth factor? How about BDNF? What does that stand for? Brain-derived natriuretic factor. Say natriuretic. Lots of times really fast. See if you can do that. They are what we call growth factors. They're involved in development and in maintenance of neurons and their normal morphology and their normal signaling activity. Okay? We've just listed 80% of what's known about growth factors by naming them. Well, that's probably a slight over-exaggeration, but not too much. And for most of the semester, we won't really bring them up much anymore, unless somebody asks a relevant question. Okay? So three different categories of membrane-associated receptors. One that causes changes in ion channel activity, one that changes the metabolism, and then one linked to one specific mechanism that possesses what we would call endogenous kinase activity. That protein itself is a kinase. Then we have the intracellular receptors, a fourth category or a second major category. And those are receptors that are found in the cytoplasm itself. So the molecules that interact with it, if they're coming from outside, have to cross the cell membrane. So what characteristic would they need to get across the cell membrane?
Lipophilic.
Be lipophilic, lipid-soluble. Not strongly charged. Probably should not be ionized. If you think back to our discussion of the LADME system, iLADME. And they can then interact with receptors in the cytoplasm, and in many cases then they're further transported across the nuclear membrane and act as transcriptional factors. So again, from your textbook, you have neurotransmitters that bind to what class of receptors? Inotropic. You have neurotransmitters that bind to metabotropic, and then neurotransmitters that bind to, that'd be logical, but no, this is also metabotropic. Okay. Your textbook doesn't talk too much about tyrosine kinase except the center two. This is an example of a couple of different configurations of metabotropic receptors. In one case, the G protein, which is coupled to it, we'll talk about G protein in just a second, interacts with an ion channel. So you have an indirect effect on an ion channel, but we don't call this an inotropic receptor, because the ion channel isn't part of the receptor itself. It's something distant from it. It's indirectly affected. In this case, you've got lots of examples of different types of enzyme systems affected by a metabotropic receptor. So the only time we talk about them being inotropic, when the ion channel is an integral part of the receptor protein itself. Doesn't mean they can't affect ion channels. Is that clear to everybody? Okay. Quickly memorize everything on this chart. Again, not very much is in color here. Keep that in mind. There are lots of different types of G protein linked receptors. And it turns out that all of the metabotropic receptors are G protein linked receptors. So we call them GPCRs, G protein coupled receptors. The coupling mechanism between the receptor and the effectors is the G protein. Please don't try to memorize the different types of G protein receptors. In humans alone, there's about 1,000 of them. I don't think anybody wants to memorize a list of 1,000 items for this first exam coming up. Right now, to give you an idea of the state of our science, more than 800 of those 1,000 we call orphan G protein receptors. Doesn't mean their parents were killed. It means we have no idea what they do. We know they're G protein coupled receptors because we can demonstrate they bind G protein. They have what we call a conserved sequence that's very similar to all the other G protein coupled receptors. We don't know what the ligand is that they bind. And we don't know in most cases what the effector is they're coupled to. So we're just sort of scratching the surface. If you think of this as we're the Titanic sailing along, these are the iceberg out there lurking, probably mediating lots of cellular effects that we have no clue about at this point in time. And in the coming years, you'll hear lots of reference to orphan G-protein-coupled receptors. Hopefully, we'll whittle that number down. We started with 100% unknown about 25 years ago. It's gotten down to only 800 unknown in humans at this point. So there has been progress. Another term that's used for G-protein-coupled receptors, we've already mentioned, is metabotropic receptors. They modify the metabolism of cells, including of neurons, as a consequence of that G-protein-coupled event. You will sometimes see them called GPLRs instead of GPCRs, G-protein-linked receptors, instead of coupled. Or another very common term is 7TMs, 7 transmembrane segment receptors. Every identified G-protein-coupled receptor has a structure that, if you're sort of an anal retentive chemist, looks like this. Each of these little spheres, if this, imagine this is in 3D, is a single amino acid. So we're looking at the amino acid sequence that makes up this G-protein-coupled receptor sequence. Certain portions of that structure are hydrophobic. They do not like to be in an aqueous solution. And the first phrase for that is they are lipophilic. They are transmembrane portions. Other portions are hydrophilic. They like to be in aqueous media. These are the charged portions of the protein structure. Some will be outside the cell, some will be intracellular. The way these are arranged, they span the membrane 7 times along their sequence, hence 7 transmembrane segments. It's an unusual ringtone. And you'll see diagrams of that shown in various ways in various texts. This one tries to give you a top view and a side view. If you count all the crossings, it should always add up to 7. With various artistic license used to show the extracellular and intracellular loops. Okay. Again, never try to memorize all the different families of G proteins unless that's going to be the topic of a doctoral dissertation you're going to do someday. Then you're going to need to know a lot more than we can fit on one chart, or 2 charts, or a dozen charts. What does this phrase mean? Sequence conservation. Hopefully you talk about issues like that in biology classes still these days.
Similar amino acid profile.
And we're talking specifically about evolutionary terms here. As these are modified through the evolutionary process, certain portions of the sequence are preserved. Others might mutate, single point mutation, for any specific amino acid. Then you would end up with a new sequence. But it's important that certain parts of the sequence stay the same. The part that binds the neurotransmitter, for instance. The part that couples to the G proteins. The part that goes through the membrane. If you lose that part of the sequence, then you have a functionally different protein. Change it enough, no longer functions as a neurotransmitter receptor, or as a G-protein coupled receptor, or has 7 transmembrane spanning segments. And that applies both to the receptor structure and to the G-proteins that bind to them. Strong conservation of the sequence. All right, so we've talked about G proteins a lot of times. What are G proteins? They are guanosine binding proteins. They bind a close relative of another one that you're used to talking about in biological systems, ATP, In this case, not ATP or ADP, to use a slightly dephosphorylated form of that, but GTP and GDP. They bind these phosphate-containing nucleotides. G proteins are typically made up of three parts, shown in a very cartoon fashion here. Don't expect that they would actually look like that, but if you drew something like that on your exam, that might work. They consist of one portion, which is monomeric. Monomer meaning one, and this portion is diffusible. When it's not attached to or bound to the other parts of the G protein, it can move around within the cell. The other two portions, although they're manufactured separately as independent proteins, they very quickly associate with one another, couple to one another, and then for the rest of their lifespan exist as a dimer, two-part system. And one portion of that, the gamma subunit, has a portion that inserts itself within the cell membrane. That sort of wiggly tail there at the top. That portion, again, is lipophilic or hydrophobic. So it stays associated with the membrane. And since the beta subunit stays associated with the gamma subunit, that whole dimer is membrane bound. Can move around on the inside of the membrane, but ordinarily it cannot then dissociate itself from the membrane. And very often you will find G proteins in a trimeric configuration. The alpha subunit, which is diffusible, bound to the beta-gamma subunit in a trimer. And when the alpha subunit is bound to the other two in that form, the whole thing then is membrane bound, not diffusible. We'll then be talking about active forms and inactive forms of these basic pieces of the G protein. And in their active forms, the alpha subunit can diffuse. It can move away from the membrane and have actions at a distance. Beta-gamma subunits are limited to moving around the membrane, typically somewhere in the close vicinity to the receptor itself, because there are barriers to movement in the membrane itself because of that attachment. So the alpha subunits tend to have the ability to have action at a greater distance. Okay. Now, lots of information on this slide. Let's go through it piece by piece. It's not so difficult. We're going to be talking about three different major families of G proteins. We'll get to that in just a minute. I want to be sure first that everybody's got the nomenclature down. What did I say G proteins were?
Guanine nucleotide
binding proteins. A lot easier to say G protein. They consist of three different subunits, two of which are typically always a dimer, always membrane bound, if we think of this green line as the membrane here. And then the alpha subunit, which is diffusible, okay. And the alpha subunit always is the portion that binds the guanine nucleotide. In this particular case, this is an inactive G protein. We know that because it contains the lower energy GDP. There's only one active state of these when the alpha subunit is bound to a GTP. And we'll talk about how that occurs in just a moment. Okay? Is that clear to everybody? All right. As you see in the title up there, there's three major families of G proteins. For each of these, we're talking about the effects of the alpha subunits, the diffusible portion that can have an action at a distance. They're called GSs, GIs, and GQs. Again, this is an oversimplification, but it's a useful oversimplification. These first two names actually have some mnemonic value, something to help you remember them. GSs do something that stimulates the activity of an enzyme system in the cell, while GIs inhibit the activity of that same enzyme system. You see some mnemonic value there? Stimulate and inhibit. GQs also stimulate something. If you could think of a word with Q, that means stimulate. You're doing better than I am. Okay. Talk first about GSs. They affect one particular enzyme system called adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase. Since most people don't like to spell, we'll use the abbreviation AC. Adenylate cyclase. They stimulate its activity. That's what the up arrow means. Increase the activity of that enzyme. They have lots of other effects as well, but those are mediated by the beta-gamma subunits. When we come to these different systems, we'll talk about those in more detail. Let's concentrate on the alpha subunit effect. Okay. GS stimulates adenylate cyclase. In the GI family, this was, of course, designed by students to make exams easy. There'd only be one member. But it's not designed by students. We're dealing with reality. There's two members of that family. The simpler one has the same name as the family. GIs, the alpha subunits of the GI. Those, instead of stimulating, inhibit adenylate cyclase. Simple enough, right? GS stimulates, GI inhibits.
So in both cases, the effect is achieved by the alpha subunit?
By the alpha subunit. There's another member of the GI family, though. Again, maybe to help you mnemonically remember it, it's also a vowel, G-O. GOs share the property that they can inhibit adenylate cyclase. But they have a slight modification in their structure so that many of them can also stimulate the other enzyme system. It's mediated by G proteins, and that's the phospholipase C system. And phospholipase C is hard for many people to spell, so we will abbreviate it PLC. Not to give too much away, the other family, GQs, specialize just in phospholipase C. They activate or stimulate phospholipase C activity. So you might think of GQs and GIs as being complementary to one another. GOs share some function with both the GIs and with GQs. What's missing from this chart? Something to turn off phospholipase C activity, to inhibit it. There are no G proteins to do that. Why is that? Nature must have taken a vacation and never got around to that one. Pardon? Phospholipase C? No, it's usually membrane bound, though.
Might be one of
the 800 orphans. But those are receptor families, not G protein families. There might be another one hiding out there. So someday there might be a GR or a GU or whatever somebody decides to name it. It will have the opposite effect. But people have been looking for it for 30 some years now, not found it. Seems likely that there's not one, but that is not definitive. Okay. There's lots of others. If you're going to become a specialist in a particular sensory system, like say the olfactory system, there are some specialized G proteins associated with certain olfactory receptors. Same for the taste system. I didn't bother to put them on. Same for the visual system. Unless you're going to become a specialist in those particular type of receptor neurons, probably not worth your time to learn them, so I didn't put them in color. You can distinguish between GS, GI, and then the other member of the GI family, the GOs, and GQs. That's more than adequate to get through the entire semester. Is that too bad? Four different categories? Compared to what it could be, not so bad. And remember, you're really only talking about regulating two enzyme systems, urate cyclase and phospholipase C. In case of phospholipase C, only in one direction, turning it up. In case of an urate cyclase, you've got some clues which way you're going to affect it. It's a consonant, it goes up. It's a vowel, it goes down. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. So how do we cause a G protein to go from an active state to an inactive state, or an inactive state to an active state? Let's look at part of the picture first, then we'll go through the whole life cycle. Which of these is the inactive state? The one bound to a GDP. In fact, you will almost never be able to capture an image of this state, because as soon as you get it into this configuration, it's highly unstable, and it literally blows apart. It dissociates extremely rapidly. This is at the point of activation of the G protein. There are three different sets of enzymes that are involved in regulation of this activity state of G proteins. These are called G protein regulators, or GPRs. G protein regulators. Let's go through them in sequence. First one's named after one of my graduate students, Jeff Farmer. No, I tease him that way every time. GEFs stand for guanine nucleotide exchange factors. They exchange guanine nucleotides. In the inactive form, you have this trimer with the alpha subunit bound to a GDP. To make it into the active form, you need to exchange that GDP for a molecule of GTP. GEFs do that. They take the GDP off and attach a GDP to the G protein, or allow it to attach to it. For that to happen, you've got to have available GTP. If there's no GTP available, GEFs can take off all the GDP they want, and it will reattach because there's not any GTP to bind to the G protein. So a necessary condition is sufficient concentration of GTP, or this will not work. Minimum is one molecule, and you would get one G protein potentially activated. Since concentration is in a big volume of space, typically that means you need lots more than one molecule of GTP for it to work efficiently. The more, the better. So now you can have an active G protein. The alpha subunit is bound to GTP. It's dissociated from the beta gamma subunit. It's free to fly off through the cell and have its effect at a distance. That is not an infinitely active process. It's limited Cells tend to like to maintain homeostasis, to have active processes go just for a short period of time and then turn them back off. So we have two different enzyme systems that help regulate that process. Turns out that alpha subunits of GTP, or I'm sorry, of the G protein, possess what we call GTPase activity. You may know what a GTPase is? It's an enzyme that uses GTP as a substrate, removes a phosphate group from the GTP, and now you have GDP left as one of the products. What is an alpha subunit bound to GDP, active or inactive? Inactive. So it can inactivate itself. Some of you are going to feel like that when you take the first exam, like you have too much GTPase activity, and you're interfering with your own function. Okay. The enzymes that help regulate that, we call GIPs and GAPs. GIPs and GAPs. Again, they have mnemonic values. One stands for GTPase inhibiting proteins. The other are called GTPase activating proteins. Which one do you think slows the process down? The GIPs. Which one would make it occur faster? GAPs. Pretty simple and straightforward. So GEFs, important to causing activation of the G proteins. GIPs and GAPs, important for regulating how long they stay active. That clear to everybody so far? So the mediation between the active and inactive state, again, is caused by these G protein regulators, the GPRs. All right, this is an important diagram to pay attention to. Should I hint more than that, Kyle? No? Hint, hint, hint. This is an important diagram to pay attention to. The life cycle of G proteins. Most textbooks get this wrong. I'd like in the future when you write your textbook that you get it correct. Okay? You'll get perhaps some practice on that in the near future. I think that's as much hint as I could possibly give. Let's arbitrarily start at this time point in a messenger cascade. Here we have a ligand out in the extracellular space in the unbound form. Remember free ligands, the one that we designated F in some of those equations? We have unbound receptors, ones we designated as R. And we have unbound inactive G proteins. And finally, we have the necessary condition to allow us to have active G proteins. We also have GTP present. All of those need to be there for this cycle to occur. First event in the cycle, it's formation of the ligand receptor complex, binding of the ligand to the receptor. What type of kinetic variables affect that? Started with K. KD and KA, rate of association, rate of dissociation. They're related to one another. The affinity of the ligand for the receptor, or vice versa. Okay. Concentration will just determine how much of it is around and then can interact, determined by those kinetic variables. All right, so first you've got to form a ligand receptor complex. At that point in time, the G protein is still inactive and still not associated with the receptor. When you have the ligand receptor complex formed for these seven transmembrane segment receptors, that we call G-protein coupled receptors. Now the affinity of that complex changes. And the G-protein now is very attracted for binding to it. Becomes a higher affinity interaction. So the third step is binding of the G-protein to the ligand receptor complex. Is that clear? Fourth step, we need to convert the inactive G-protein, we know it's still inactive because it's got a GDP bound, to an active G-protein. And to do that, we need a Jeff to cause the exchange. Strip off the GDP and allow the GTP in the vicinity to bind. A Jeff has to be involved. At that point, labeled number 5 here, we have a very unstable situation. It's like a bomb and the fuse has been lit. You have the G protein bound to the ligand receptor complex, and it's in this unstable state with a GTP bound to it. At that point in time, the system dissociates. The ligand receptor stay bound to one another. They have their own kinetic properties. The alpha subunit comes loose and diffuses away. The beta gamma subunit comes loose and is restricted to moving across the membrane. Now the beta gamma subunit can look for a target. If there's something nearby, it might influence it. The alpha subunit, with the GTP attached, can diffuse away and look for a target. An enzyme system might take some of those phosphate groups away and use it to cause other biological activity. Eventually, again mediated by these different G-protein regulatory proteins, GPRs, either a GAP or a GIP will speed up or slow down this endogenous GTPase activity. And at some point in time, we go back to an inactive alpha subunit. And we know it's inactive because it's bound to a GDP, not to a GTP. One of those phosphate groups has been stripped off. At this particular point in time, we're now no longer in this unstable state. Now the affinity of the alpha subunit and the beta gamma subunits is high again. And if they're in the vicinity of one another, they will bind. This oversimplified view makes it look like this alpha subunit always goes with that beta gamma, whatever one is close by. So these rebind to one another. It's another event. And the final event necessary for the dissociation constant to be passed so that the ligand unbinds from the receptor. And the cycle can begin again. Lots of steps. If you were asked to diagram this, you'd better include all of them with full explanation. Or I think Kyle will not be very merciful. Pretty pictures are probably not what he's looking for. Am I wrong? Okay. But pretty pictures aren't bad.
No, I mean, it's pretty inaccurate.
They're pretty inaccurate. Maybe he'll give you a bonus point. That's what I said, pretty inaccurate. If they're pretty inaccurate, not so much. Okay. Everybody clear on the life cycle of G-proteins?
So the ligand at number 9 step?
Uh-huh.
Binds the receptor?
It was bound, now it has to come unbound.
So the ligand is free, so is it possible that the ligand will bind with another receptor?
Sure, or it might be taken back up by a transporter back into a cell, or it might be broken down.
But it won't bind with the same receptor?
It could. It's impossible to say which of those would occur for any given set of molecules. Yes?
Is the concentration of GPRs variable?
Yes. They are regulated in and of themselves. Everything in here is regulated. Amounts of GTP, numbers of receptors, amount of neurotransmitter, all of it's regulated. And varies. And if something breaks down in any of these steps, the cycle doesn't go forward.
Thyroid hormone uses GLP proteins. So, but the red version is like phosphodiesterase. Is that GIP selective phosphodiesterase?
No. Nope, that's a completely different pathway. We'll cover that after a while, too. Not today, though. Again, we didn't have many math fans. I don't expect you to memorize any equations related to the kinetics of these interactions. But again, those of you that think you want to continue studying pharmacology, expect to see some math at some point in time. Probably not this semester, though. Let's talk about that change from the active to the inactive state of the alpha subunit. Remember, in the active state, the alpha subunit binds GTP. This is the chemical structure of GTP. I don't expect you to be able to reproduce that. This isn't an organic chemistry class. Okay. The GTPase activity works at the end of this backbone. Strips phosphate groups off from that end of the molecule. About 35 years ago now, the chemist discovered that if you substituted for that charged oxygen out there, a sulfhydryl group here, you could block the activity of GTPases. Couldn't be stripped off. Now you have a permanently active G protein if it's bound to this form of GTP. This has got a sulfhydryl group. It was called GTP gamma S. That's the gamma phosphate group, gamma S. This is considered a toxin. If you apply that to normal cells and you keep the alpha subunit turned on for an abnormal period of time, most normal result is that the cell dies. Cells like these to be time-limited events. So this is considered to be a non-hydrolyzable form of GTP. You can't strip off that phosphate group. It's useful experimentally. If you want to see what this G protein is causing to have happen in the cell, it might be nice if that effect lasted long enough that you could measure it or produced a large enough quantity of whatever that reaction product was to measure it. But if you want to have a living cell, not a good thing. If you've ever watched anyone that had diarrhea as a consequence of cholera, multiply that by a few million times. Not a good agent to expose yourself to. But in a laboratory setting, it's a useful tool. But we would consider this to be a toxin. There's other toxins associated with G proteins. Well-known toxins. Right now, there's a lot of talk in the news about cholera epidemics in Haiti. Turns out that cholera is a waterborne bacteria that releases toxins that are readily cell permeant so they can get into the circulatory system, cross the blood-brain barrier even if you live long enough, and bind to alpha subunits of G proteins. Cholera toxin binds to the alpha subunits of GSs, ones that stimulate adenylate cyclase activity. have effects very similar to GTP gamma S. They keep these G proteins active for a long period of time. There's also one that binds slightly different location on the sequence of members of the GI family, GIs and GOs. Different type of bacteria, different type of toxin called pertussis toxin. Causes a disease that used to be called whooping cough. Had almost been completely eradicated in the U.S. until people decided that perhaps vaccination was causing autism. With no actual valid scientific data, started promoting the idea, stop vaccinating children.
The guy who wrote that paper lost his medical license.
That hasn't stopped the idea, though.
Yeah, I know.
Unfortunately. As a consequence, there's a lot of children now that are sensitive to this bacterial toxin. And it can have fatal consequences. Normally, if you go into a clinic and get what's called a tetanus shot, it will often be a DPT shot. Inoculate you against another toxin that doesn't interact with G proteins called diphtheria. One is pertussis for this G protein mediated effect. The other is tetanus, and we talked about tetanus toxin earlier and might be something relevant for your first exam. The defected transmitter release. So why would you need to be vaccinated against those things? Take your chances. Maybe there's too much population in the world. That might boost that line of thought too. Keep in mind though that even the Nazis continued vaccinating people. These are deadly diseases. And gee, knowing about G proteins helps explain how they work. Again, anything in color on this slide? No, because we're going to go into this in more detail than I can fit on one slide Thursday. Talking about things beyond the G proteins. Since it's not the first set of messengers, the receptors and things that directly interact with those receptors, the kind of loose terminology that's been adopted is we call them second messengers, things that happen after that. Pharmacologists are not big on counting. So they might be third messengers or fourth messengers or 18th messengers. They're all called second messengers. Any number higher than two is too many. We'll use that as a rule of thumb when we're looking at different drugs and stuff. For most systems, I'll try to limit it to, when possible, to two drugs for any given set of relationships. I can promise I'll always do that because none of you are actually pharmacologists, right? So some of you can handle big numbers like three. Or maybe even four, maybe even five. But usually we'll deal just with two. For most purposes, that's probably enough. Okay? We're going to talk about some confounds in pharmacology. Name a neurotransmitter.
Acetylcholine.
Okay, that's one neurotransmitter. Turns out there are multiple kinds of receptors for acetylcholine. Okay? There's nicotinic receptors and muscarinic receptors. There's about half a dozen different types of nicotinic receptors within that. Five different types of muscarinic receptors that we know of. So for any given neurotransmitter, there's lots of different types of effectors. Lots of different types of receptors. And say, one of those was a G protein coupled receptor in the GI family. If it happened to be, say, a GO coupled receptor, it could affect both phospholipase C and adenylate cyclase. Turn one of them up and turn the other one's activity down. So any given neurotransmitter can have multiple effects. And to be a good student of pharmacology, you need to understand all of the above. Same time, we have the other effect going on. We would talk about this as divergence of the effects of a transmitter. We also have an effect that looks like convergence, narrowing down. So for instance, there are acetylcholine receptors and dopamine receptors and norepinephrine receptors, and in fact serotonin and glutamate receptors, each of which has their own unique type of receptor for that neurotransmitter, but they all converge on the same effector system. How many types of G proteins were there? There's only four total. And how many enzymes were affected by those? Two. So they more or less have to converge. They converge either on adenylate cyclase or on phospholipase C, if they're G protein coupled receptors. How about ions that move across the membrane? There's thousands of types of those, right? I hope you would not answer that on the quiz. How many elements are there on the periodic table? 100 and some on, okay? And we could be wrong if we gave a precise answer. Because in Switzerland right now, they might find a new one. At CERN. But not all of those move through ion channels. Only a handful move through ion channels. So again, we have convergence even for inotropic receptors. Sodium, calcium, potassium, chloride for normal neuronal function. And we'll have to deal with those complexities. Some things do the same thing, some things do multiple things. Part of this is in color. I apologize for that because the artist put it in color. I didn't. This looks incredibly complex right now. By the end of the semester, you'll look at diagrams like this and go, oh, that's not got enough detail on it. They left out X, Y, and Z on there. I know better than that now. Right now, though, this looks bewilderingly complex. But expect by the end of the semester, it won't. At this point in time, I don't expect you to deal with that level of complexity. Okay? Some of you could do better already, right? That's it for today.